DW.
Deutsche Welle.
News.
This is Jesse Wingard in Bonn. Tonight's World Cup final between Germany and Argentina has just got underway. Both sides named an unchanged team for the game at Rio de Janeiro's Maracanã Stadium. Mats Hummels started at centre-back despite dealing with tendonitis. Five-goal top scorer Thomas Müller lined up on the right flank to support striker Miroslav Klose. Two-time champions Argentina are appearing in their first final since 1990 when they lost to West Germany. Three-time winner of Germany last reached the final in 2001, losing to Brazil. Meanwhile, police launched tear gas and stun grenades to disperse more than 300 anti-World Cup protesters who tried to march toward Maracanã Stadium. The demonstrators were protesting against police repression and the country's healthcare system. Palestinians living in Gaza are fleeing their homes as Israel warned of further attacks on rocket launching sites. The Israeli military told 70,000 residents in a Gaza town near the northern border with Israel to evacuate. A senior military official said Israel would strike with might from late Sunday evening. He did not indicate if Sunday's offensive would expand into a full-scale ground operation. Palestinian officials say the six-day offensive has killed at least 160 people. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry insists Washington and Berlin remain great friends, despite a new spying scandal. Meeting on the sidelines of nuclear talks in Vienna, Kerry and German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier acknowledged the value of working together on issues such as Iran and the violence in Israel and Palestine. Earlier this week, Germany ordered the CIA chief based in Berlin to leave the country after revelations about widespread US spying in Germany. You're listening to Deutsche Welle News. Representatives from six world powers are in Vienna for talks with Iran about its controversial nuclear program. US Secretary of State John Kerry and the foreign ministers from Germany, Britain and France, as well as Chinese and Russian representatives, are meeting in a bid to reach a deal with Iran on curbing its nuclear activities. In exchange, international sanctions that have crippled the country's oil-dependent economy would gradually be lifted. Iran says it is using uranium for peaceful energy purposes. Iraq's parliament has failed to break a political deadlock and form a new government. After a brief parliamentary session on Sunday, officials delayed efforts to reach an agreement between Shiite, Sunni and Kurdish politicians on the positions of Prime Minister, President and Parliamentary Speaker until Tuesday. The incumbent Prime Minister is seeking a third term but is facing strong opposition. Following Sunday's inconclusive session, bomb attacks struck Baghdad and its suburbs. Six people were killed in the blasts, which struck a busy street and marketplace. Relative calm has returned to the area surrounding Libya's main airport. Earlier on Sunday, rival rebel groups clashed at Tripoli's international airport, halting all flights. Officials say at least six people died in the clashes, with 25 injured. The airport will stay closed for at least 3 days. An Islamist group attacked the airport controlled by the rebels in town militia. The mounting violence prompted the United Nations support mission in Libya on Thursday to announce their staff would be leaving the country. North Korea has launched two ballistic missiles into the East Sea on Sunday, according to reports by South Korea's military. The missiles were fired from the North Korean city of Kaesong, near the border with the South. The launches are the latest in a series of missile tests by the North, apparently in response to a joint annual naval exercise between the US and South Korea, scheduled for next week. United Nations resolutions do not allow North Korea to own nor fire ballistic missiles. German Chancellor Angela Merkel and Russian President Vladimir Putin met Sunday for talks, acknowledging the situation in Ukraine was degrading and called for dialogue between Kiev and pro-Russian separatists. For more news and information, our website dw.de. Jesse Wingard, Deutsche Welle News.
Deutsche Welle.
Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sweeney in Bonn. On today's programme, as terrorists become more innovative, can governments keep pace?
It will always be very difficult to discover a bomb that is surgically implanted within someone's body, especially if you're talking about things like plastic explosives that cannot easily be detected by any machine.
Also inside Europe, concern in Russia over the future of online freedoms. Is life returning to normal in Kiev? And glitz, glamour and controversy at the Czech Republic's premier cultural event. Those stories and more coming up on the program. Airport security has been tightened across Europe after a warning from the US about a possible new threat from Islamic terrorists. The American authorities have called for stricter controls on direct flights to the US. There are concerns that two branches of Al-Qaeda are working on a bomb which may not be picked up during screening. From London, Stephen Beard reports.
Britain appears to be taking the threat more seriously than most. All passengers flying into or out of the UK, whether to the United States or not, could be affected by the extra security. Prime Minister David Cameron insisted his government was not overreacting.
What we've done is put in place some extra precautions and extra checks. You know, the safety of the travelling public must come first. We mustn't take any risks with that. I hope this won't lead to unnecessary delays, but it's very important that we always put safety first, and we do.
Along with the existing restrictions on carrying liquids or sharp instruments on board, passengers now face extra checks on their electronic devices. If it's battery operated, it will have to be charged so it can be switched on. If the battery is flat, the passenger may be forced to leave the laptop or cell phone behind. Peter Neumann, a security expert at King's College London, says the crackdown's been prompted by a warning from the US.
The Americans have received intelligence that bomb makers from Yemen, from Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is one of the main Al-Qaeda affiliates, have traveled to Syria and are plotting to put bombs on planes that are on the way from Europe to America. That's the nature of the threat.
The Yemeni bomb makers have proved increasingly ingenious. They've hidden explosives in toothpaste, shoes, and ink cartridges. Now officials say they've developed non-metal and low-vapor devices, which are much easier to conceal. Roland Alford is an explosives expert.
When you come to detect explosives, one of the traditional ways of doing it is by sniffing. So using an electronic sniffer, you could use a dog. A low-vapor explosive, or low-vapor pressure explosive, is one that doesn't really give off any vapor, so there's nothing to sniff, and that's what makes them ideal for smuggling through security.
ACDs, they're called. It stands for Actually Concealed Devices. The methods of concealment have become more extreme and threatening. There have been cases of bombs secreted inside the bomber's rectum, or even implanted surgically. Peter Neumann.
It will always be very difficult to discover a bomb that is surgically implanted within someone's body, especially if you're talking about things like plastic explosives that cannot easily be detected by any machine.
Some security experts say the current generation of bomb detection equipment's been overtaken by the bomber's diabolical ingenuity. It's time for a different approach, says Philip Baum, editor of Airport Security International magazine.
We continually rely on technologies that were developed to respond to the last threat rather than implementing an intelligent approach to aviation security that is based on behavioral analysis, based on profiling, and utilizes technology intelligently to screen passengers in an appropriate manner.
He advocates a more targeted approach, with security officials focusing more closely on those passengers that are most likely to pose a threat. And, for example, watching their body language as they line up to check in. Critics complain this might unfairly stigmatize people of Middle Eastern origin and appearance, but Baum brushes that objection aside.
Imagine when you get off a plane in Heathrow at the moment, or any airport, and you go through customs. Customs don't pull everybody aside for screening. They pull those people who they believes may be carrying something that they shouldn't be carrying. Immigration deal with people differently. Every security agency differentiates between the people that they're supposed to screen, except airport security, where suddenly we all have to be politically correct. It's all got to be everybody treated the same, and that is not good security.
$228 million passengers a year fly into and out of UK airports like Heathrow. Screening them all effectively would be a monumental task, leading to further very long delays. But these passengers at least said they'd welcome much more rigorous security.
It's peace of mind. I think you'd rather know that you've been thoroughly searched and everyone else on your plane has been thoroughly searched, rather than it being highlighted when something does happen that there are lapses in security.
Anyone who's travelled anywhere in the past, whether since 9/11, you're just used to it, aren't you? You know the scenario. You just do it automatically now, I think.
And with the summer holiday approaching and further security measures and delays expected, that forbearance may begin to fray. Stephen Beard, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
In Russia, there's growing concern over the future of online freedoms. The Russian authorities have passed several new laws that will expand the already immense powers of the Federal Security Services to control information flow on the internet. From Moscow, Charles Maines has the details.
Officially, the legislation is part of a broader anti-terrorism bill, but internet analysts say, make no mistake, the measures collectively restrict the free flow of information and independent thought online. Andrei Soldatov is an investigative journalist with Agenta.ru, a news service specializing in coverage of Russia's security services.
It's not about one law. The Russian approach is mostly about instigation censorship, and we see that the media landscape and how people talk online is already changing. And I struggled with my friends, well, many became more cautious and expressing their views.
In recent weeks, websites of several leading opposition figures and news organizations have been blocked for extremism over their nuanced coverage of events in Ukraine. New laws since introduced require popular bloggers to register as media outlets, exposing them to libel suits for content and even reader comments. And even everyday users now face potential penalties for retweeting messages on Twitter that authorities deem extremist. Pro-democracy activists say this is important because with traditional media largely under state control, the internet has come to serve as many Russians' main source for independent news and unfettered debate. But they say it's a debate the government now seems determined to moderate. Sarkis Derbinyan is a lawyer and internet activist affiliated with the Russian Association of Internet Users.
The authorities came to understand that the internet wielded enormous power, especially after the Arab Spring and after the events in Ukraine. And I think it scares certain people in the Kremlin that this could happen in Russia.
It was little more than 2 years ago that Russia's opposition used the internet to help organize mass street protests against the return of Russian President Vladimir Putin to power. That protest movement ultimately fizzled, but authorities have looked for ways ever since to restrict the influence of the web, and social media in particular. And they appear to have found it in a former NSA contractor turned whistleblower named Edward Snowden.
I'd like to ask you a question about the mass event online communications and the one collection of private records by intelligence and law enforcement services.
Since giving Snowden asylum in Russia last year, the Kremlin has played up Snowden's revelations at every turn, even providing the American with a prime-time opportunity to submit a question to Vladimir Putin during the Russian leader's annual national press conference last April.
So I have to ask you, does Russia intercept, store, or block in any way the communications of millions of individuals?
Mr. Putin's answer, an unequivocal no. But that is what the authorities have done, says the lawyer Sarkis Derbinyan, under the guise of protecting Russians' user information from the Americans. Under another new law, tech companies hoping to do business in Russia must host their servers on Russian soil starting in 2016. Now, that may not sound like news to locals, but according to Derbinyan, the law's real target is giving the government access to user profile data held by tech giants like Google, Twitter, and Facebook.
After Snowden's revelations that the American services were monitoring internet users, our authorities said, okay, we don't want the Americans to monitor our people, we want to monitor them. And so, paradoxically, the country that took Snowden in has become one of the leaders in spying on its own citizens.
Well, these tech companies could refuse to comply, and of course they still might, but says investigative journalist Andrei Soldatov, their track record suggests otherwise.
2 years ago, I never thought that Twitter would block something on the request of Russian authorities. The same might happen via Facebook. Now, they have plenty of examples.
Which is to say, in this summer season, Russia's internet users may find their best bet is to unplug, talk to their friends, their real friends, and if in search of news and information, maybe it's time to just turn on the radio. Charles Maines, DW, Moscow.
And staying in Russia, it's being reported that President Putin is set to write off 90% of Cuba's debt in a show of fraternal love. Emma Wallace has the details.
President Putin headed to Havana on Friday for his latest visit to the cash-strapped Caribbean island of Cuba. Presumably as a sweetener ahead of his trip, Putin waited until now to have the Russian parliament, the Duma, ratify an agreement signed back in October 2013. The agreement signed by both countries was that Russia would write off $32 billion of a $34 billion debt, as long as Cuba promised to pay back the remaining $3.2 billion over the next 10 years. The repayments are due to start in the autumn as the Duma returns from the summer break. The debts were accrued in the 70s and 80s when communist ties between the two countries saw a lot of trade and exchanges between Havana and the Eastern Bloc. But Russia is also not so solvent economically, and it was reported by Russian press agencies that some politicians tried to oppose the debt write-off, saying that it was all very well talking about fraternal countries, but what about the Russian people? Whilst Russians may be dreaming of sunning themselves on Caribbean beaches, the cosmonaut-turned-politician Valentina Tereshkova, who supported Putin's policy, reminded her colleagues that Cuba had already welcomed some 40,000 Soviet children to its shores to recover from the Chernobyl nuclear disaster in 1986, and that this deal, Russia hopes, will lead to a raft of investment and trade deals being signed between Russia and Cuba to take the two countries into a brave new future. Emma Wallace, DW.
And I'm Helen Senior Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. As fighting continues in the east of Ukraine, international focus has shifted away from the country's capital. Things have quietened down in Kiev since the height of the protests that overthrew President Viktor Yanukovych in February. But it seems the revolution isn't quite over, as journalist Dave Goodman found recently when visiting the city for the first time since 2005. Here's his postcard from Kiev.
I sat on the top of a red sightseeing bus just near Independence Square, or the Maidan as it's known to Ukrainians, and now millions around the world. A leaflet promised all the sights of Kiev in just 90 minutes. It was a scorching hot Sunday afternoon, and I thought a breezy bus ride would cool me off. To one side of the bus, in front of a derelict building and a makeshift hut, was a stall selling colourful cartoons satirising Vladimir Putin and Ukraine's deposed leader, Viktor Yanukovych. You could buy doormats and toilet paper with their faces on them, or fridge magnets of a golden loaf of bread, or even a golden toilet. Both were found in Yanukovych's palatial house when he fled Ukraine back in February. I was impressed to see such humor in what was such a sad situation. On the other side of the bus, there were men in camouflage helping old women lay flowers on a coffin inside a hearse. I watched as a procession of mourners chanted slogans about Ukraine as the car drove away. The bus hadn't moved for 10 minutes, and I was virtually on my own, The only other passengers were a blonde Ukrainian woman and her restless child. I was told we would leave when there were at least four of us on board. The child didn't count. After half an hour in the glare of the afternoon sun, no one else had got on. We were told to come back an hour later, and maybe there would be more people. I decided it was unlikely. I wasn't that surprised at the lack of interest. Kiev can't be top of most people's summer holiday lists right now. But I wanted to see if the city had changed since my last visit 9 years ago, following the last revolution. I decided to walk back up into the Maidan itself. In 2005, I remember the square was filled with young people drinking on a summer's night. Now Kiev's main square resembled an army camp. Khaki tents everywhere, with flags flying above them. The bright blue and yellow of the Ukrainian flag, of course, but I could see American ones, Azeri, Armenian, British flags too. There were piles of grey bricks dug up from the pavement and barricades with pictures pinned to them of young and old men who had died in the square. Next to them, collection boxes and candles surrounded makeshift shrines, and men in army fatigues were huddled. I took some pictures, and then some of these men asked to see my camera. After looking through my holiday snaps and realizing I wasn't a government spy, they handed it back and said sorry. I don't think they were expecting to find many tourists around here either. But the city itself felt quieter than my last visit. Understandably, more sedate. Fewer people on the streets, although the metro was still packed. The following day, I decided to visit the city's newest attraction. Since he fled to Russia in February, Viktor Yanukovych's 140-hectare country estate just outside Kiev has been open to the curious public. Standing in beautiful landscaped gardens is the old president's old pad. $100 million worth of French chateau meets Swiss chalet. Near the gate, a man was wandering around posing for pictures, dressed as a king with a giant Yanukovych head. And then I watched small groups of Ukrainians peering in the windows of the mansion to see the excesses inside. The glistening man-made lakes and fountains felt very far away from the car tires and barricades in the Maidan, and even further away from the fighting in Donetsk and Luhansk. I paid just €1 to see inside Yanukovych's spa, which was five times as big as the average Kiev apartment. The plushly decorated interior boasted mosaics, a stone floor, carved wood walls, an enormous plunge pool, showers, as well as a sofa area with a big flat-screen TV. And then, in the corner, I spied the sauna itself. Fairly ordinary, but for the big V carved into the wall. And next to it, a bathroom. There were gold taps, a gold toilet brush holder, but sadly, no gold toilet. I'd seen enough, so I decided to leave the acres of green surrounding Yanukovych's house and took a bus back into town through the acres of grey tower blocks that characterise the outskirts of many old Soviet cities. I couldn't help but wonder on the journey, with so much change in Ukraine since I last came nearly 10 years ago, would I be visiting another president's house on my next trip?
That was Dave Goodman with that postcard from Kiev. Well, in the Czech Republic, the spa town of Karlovy Vary has been hosting its International Film Festival this week. It's an annual ritual of obsessive film watching and hardcore partying. Somewhere between Cannes and Glastonbury, Vary, as it's known, is the country's premier social and cultural event. But this year there's been a hint of controversy, as Rob Cameron reports.
This year, the great and the good, and it has to be said, the mediocre, from the worlds of Czech business, politics and showbiz, descend on this sleepy spa town for a hedonistic 10-day celebration of cinematography. This year has been no exception. 200 films showing in a dozen cinemas, crowds flocking the concrete edifice of the hotel terminal, and few going to sleep before 2 a.m. Adding the requisite Hollywood glamour this year was Mel Gibson, who opened a special outdoor showing of his cult classic Mad Max, and also his movie Apocalypto, which he directed in 2006. This is the 2004 film, The Passion of the Christ, that still causes controversy. The Czech Jewish community wrote an angry letter to the festival's president after the announcement that he would receive the Crystal Globe Lifetime Achievement Award, claiming the film is anti-Semitic. Mel Gibson spoke to me on the red carpet shortly before receiving that award.
Fantastic, you know. I mean, it's like I'm so, gratified and honored to sort of accept it. You know, I came here. I've never been to the Czech Republic before, so, you know, it's a good experience for me. So far, so good. You know.
Fantastic reception out there.
Oh, yeah. Must be fantastic. Tremendous. Yeah. You know, one, if you go to a lot of places in the world, you realize you've left a mark someplace or an impression somehow.
Yeah, no, I just asked if the Czech Jewish community has issued a poll. I'm not sure if you're aware of it. Issued a statement complaining about the award.
No, I don't know anything about that. We've dealt with this. This is an eight-year-old controversy, and I've dealt with it the best way I know how, and made all the necessary, you know, inter-exchanges, apologies, all this kind of stuff. So, you know, it's just noise.
It's easy to forget, amidst all the glitz and glamour, that such festivals are also about business, a place where film industry types press the flesh and do deals on production, financing, and distribution. I had the chance to sit down briefly with Isabella Giordano, Director General of Unifrance Films, whose mission is to promote French cinema throughout the world.
Our goal is to have a better market share and to sell more and more French films. And on the second hand, I can say that it's important to see the reaction of the audience. What do they expect? What do they want? I want people to be aware of French films, of the diversity of French films, of the quality of French films. So maybe to do more publicity, advertising. So we have to find more ideas because the market is tougher and tougher. It's very tough. And you know that Hollywood movies are very powerful. We are not so powerful. But we are the second biggest seller worldwide in the industry.
The French film industry feels squeezed by Hollywood and the English language film industry.
Yes and no. Yes, it's obvious.